Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Now, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening Ron Brown, who's a supporter of our efforts here at Radio Liberty. But Ron is in the coin business. He's been following gold and silver along, since the late 1970s. And we have him on from time to time because I think it's vitally important that at least the listeners to our program understand what's going on in the world. Somebody once said that love makes the world go round. Well, also money makes the world go round. In fact, everything we do in many respects is related to money. We have to have money to buy the things we need and to pay taxes on our property. Without some means of exchange, the whole economy would begin to collapse. And money has been used down through the ages. Certainly it was used at the time when our Lord walked the earth. It was used, as the standard of exchange here in the United States. It was always tied to gold and silver, and that was the stipulation in our founding documents, because our founding fathers knew what had happened during the Revolutionary War when they'd issued a paper currency. It was called the Continental, and before long they had a phrase called, "It not worth a Continental." They knew what had happened when Diocletian in 300 A.D. had debased the currency of Rome. They knew what had happened when they debased the currency of ancient Greece. They knew about John Law in the early 1700s in France. And, of course, it wasn't long after our Constitution was invoked. They had the French Revolution, followed by another fiat money system that collapsed. And so our founding fathers wanted our currency to be based upon gold and silver. And for many years it was, and we prospered. But then, of course, came the Second World War, and America had most of the gold. And after the war, or at the end of the war, about 1944, I think it was, that they established the Bretton Woods Agreement, which established a new world monetary system tied to the American dollar, and the dollar was as good as gold. And for a time, gold was exchangeable. Silver was in our currency. And then in the mid-1960s, why they took the silver backing away from our currency on August 15, 1971, President Clinton took America off the gold. But still, our currency was stable and people wanted American dollars. It was the reserve currency of the world. And it is established, it has provided a fair amount of security for people in the United States and certainly throughout the world. Most of the major countries of the world have their reserve currencies, the reserve that backs their currency, largely in American dollars. Well, how much longer is that going to last when America today has to borrow $1.7 billion every day just to keep our country going? And with massive deficits, the largest deficits ever recorded in all of human history, will be here in America this year. It took America from 1789 until 1980. That's almost 200 years, 190 years, to run up a debt of $1 trillion. And yet this year, between now and the middle of next year, we will increase our national debt almost $750 billion. We've never been in a situation like this with such massive government spending, and they're really not even telling you the truth about that, because they're going to have more money for the war over in Iraq the way it's going, and they know that. And 6 months ago, the military was saying that they needed another $50 billion, and they were going to have to ask for that, though, after the election, because they didn't want the American people to know before the election. Well, we're having real problems. And Ron, you were saying that there's information up on the internet today that certain of the European countries and even the Arabic countries are beginning to talk about purchasing oil in euros rather than in dollars. What's the story?
Well, of course, there's been speculation for the last 2, 3, 4 years, I guess, that would eventually happen. And the talk is really heating up. Now, I don't know whether it's official yet, but there was talk on the internet that Russia and OPEC were in the process or about to switch price in their oil, not in dollars, but in euros. And, of course, that would have an absolutely devastating impact on America.
Well, of course, Russia is one of the big oil producers right now, and you know, right along behind OPEC and rapidly catching up with them. I don't know, they got a million or million and a half barrels of oil they're exporting. So if the oil exporting countries begin demanding payment in euros, what will that do to the value of the dollar? What will it do to the fact that the countries all over the world are holding all these dollars? Whatever happens if they start to unload those dollars on the market?
Well, as you just mentioned, we have been the world's reserve currency, and that gave us certain benefits because the whole world was putting their reserve monies in terms of dollar investments. So in effect, the foreigners, because we were the world's reserve currency, because they were competing for our trade dollar, were in effect financing our folly and financing our deficits for these last 30 or 40 years. If we ever lose that status as the world's reserve currency, then they will have no reason to be holding those dollars, especially since the dollar is dropping at, what, 15% a year. It's not really a very good investment if you're earning 3, 4, 5% on your bonds and you're losing 15% on the exchange rate. So once that happens, what will in turn and trigger a rise in interest rates, because then we will be scrambling to get people to finance our deficits, and that will force interest rates higher. And of course, when that happens, the bond market crashes, so the thing will really start to exacerbate at that point.
Well, now, what about the real estate market? If they start raising the interest rates, won't that impact on the real estate bubble? I mean, this is the wildest bubble I've ever seen. You know, here in California, some of the houses going up in value 10, almost sometimes 20% a year here this last year or two.
I was talking with a client in La Jolla, and when I first met her, and she actually called me from your show 6, 7, 8 months ago, I don't remember exactly when, but she was telling me she had a house in La Jolla, and I think it was like 1,700 square feet, you know, a pretty vanilla house, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and she was saying it was worth $700,000, and of course, living out here in Colorado, it's just hard for me to comprehend just a plain vanilla house would be that expensive. Well, I talked to her a week before last, and some developer came in and bought the house on each side of her, fixed them up a little bit, and put them on the market, I think, at $1.1 million. So it's just it's something going berserk, and it kind of reminds you of the end of the dot-com bubble. If you'll recall, everyone was rushing out to use their credit cards to buy dot-com stocks right before the crash.
Well, you know, it's interesting that we've seen this down through history. There was the tulip mania in Holland years ago. There was the land exploitation in Florida many years ago. This has happened over and over again throughout history, where people are just buying frantically, figuring the prices are going to continue to rise, get in, you're going to make a lot of money. And unfortunately, pretty soon when that bubble bursts, why, the people who end up owning the property or the tulips or the matches or the Florida swampland suddenly find that they really are in real trouble. Ronnie, are there?
I'm here.
Okay, fine.
And of course, part of the problem there is the people who warn the masses of what's happening is the bubble, and they'd warn them to get out. For example, the stock market bubble in the 90s. The conservatives were warning people to get out when the Dow was maybe 3,000 or 4,000, and of course it went on to 12,000. So for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the conservatives trying to warn people of what was going to happen were way too early, because you never know when a bubble will end. So they get discredited 2, 3 years before the collapse, you know, and then of course when the collapse comes, everyone gets massacred almost overnight.
Well, of course, the one thing that we have to have people do is get out of debt, certainly not go on a buying spree, and this is not the time to buy a house. This is the time to rent a house or to sell your house and rent one, because there are many people who think that the price of housing, sometime in the next few years, nobody knows exactly when, but the price of houses may decrease, decline between 50 and 80%. Have you heard talk about that?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that could happen. The only thing that would could maybe change that, although it wouldn't change the reality of it, is if our monetary authorities keep running the printing press like they are, and every time something fails, they have to bail it out, and they're having to print money faster and faster and faster, we could have a 21 German-style hyperinflation, in which case the housing market and the real estate market and everything would go up violently in price, given the illusion that you were making money, but the reality is that the currency was losing value so fast, as it did in Germany, that you were actually going broke.
And people have never seen an inflationary spiral like that here in America, and I hope and pray we never see one. But there are only certain things that the government can do. They can either contract the money supply, let people lose their homes and lose their cars and lose their jobs and shut down the economy to prevent inflation, or they can keep massively expanding the monetary supply. But my concern is that there are tens of trillions of dollars of money, three or four, five, eight, I don't know how many trillions of dollars in other countries. And if those foreigners ever want to get rid of their money, why, it will have a disastrous effect on what happens here at home, because all that money will come and simply flood into this country and create inflation. We've been able to export our inflation to other countries for years, but that day may be coming to an end. And if this does happen and people have not made preparations for it, those people who have not stand to lose everything, as we've seen in Argentina here about 2 or 3 years ago, where they totally wiped out the middle class. And about 50% of the people down there live below the poverty line. And what was just a few years ago a very, very prosperous country. So people say it could never happen here. And I would ask, why not? We have violated every economic law. We've taken the gold and silver backing away from the country. We've created artificial expectations. The American people believe nothing bad could ever happen here. And then, of course, you look beyond that, and you look at the spiritual aspect of this country that's turned its back on God. And I would simply ask, why wouldn't God bring chastisement to this country? Well, do you want to talk a little bit about what's happening in the silver market, Ron? Because that is one of the most fascinating examples of lawlessness I've ever seen. There are laws against manipulating the commodity market and the stock market. We know that the government is sending the plunge protection team in to keep the stock market up. Most of the stocks are selling 20 to 30 times price earnings ratio. They should be down around 10 if this were really even close to the bottom of a market. But what's happening in the silver market? Because this has suddenly dropped off a dollar an ounce here in this last few days.
Well, before we do that, let me just take a second and establish a foundation for the manipulation of the market. When we went to a fiat currency, of course, the only thing that gives our money value is confidence. Gold and silver have been real monies throughout history, and so they have become like a barometer of confidence in the paper money system. So if people lose confidence in paper money as they are today, then they start to seek the refuge of gold and silver, and then silver and gold start to rise, and that spreads alarm throughout the world that the fiat system's in trouble, which of course is exactly what's happening. Now, that being the case, then the people in power trying to preserve and keep this, what I call a bogus system going, based on fiat and just creating money out of nothing, they will always try to manipulate and suppress the price. So the people will not see that the danger that is coming. They'll assume since gold and silver is not doing anything, then everything must be hunky-dory. Well, they've been manipulating the price of gold and silver for many, many years, but for the last 5-10 years, the gold market and the silver market. The problem they have in the silver market is that they don't have any silver to dump into the market the way they do with gold. You know, with the gold market, the central banks own massive amounts of gold, and they can just dump that into the market to keep the price down. But with silver, we've been consuming the silver that took 4,000 years to accumulate, and we basically consumed it over the last 40 years. It's now gone. So the insiders have no silver to manipulate the market with, so what they have to do is manipulate it in the COMEX, or the futures market. So what they do there is just simply come in whenever there is demand in the futures market that would drive silver up. They come in and take the other side of the equation and sell silver. But what they're really doing is selling contracts for someone to take delivery of. This is like an option contract.
But if anybody were to buy their silver, demand their silver, there isn't any silver there to get, is there?
Right, and that's what we're approaching, is that point where it's what's called a squeeze, where the people on the long side, the people who have bought silver on contract, have the authority, and when they start asking for delivery, if the people on the other side who are contracted to deliver don't have the silver to develop or to deliver, then you have a real crisis and a default, and of course that throws the whole COMEX and the commodity market into convulsions. And a lot of people might remember what happened back in the 70s when Bunker Hunt was taking delivery of silver and they couldn't meet the deliveries.
Can you speak just a little louder, or your voice is fading out just a little bit?
Okay.
You were mentioning the Bunker Hunt back in the late, about 1980, was trying to buy up a lot of the silver, and there just wasn't any silver delivery, and the price went up to $50 an ounce. I remember that very well.
Right.
But then they changed the rules. Bunker Hunt didn't understand that in the middle of the game, sort of like a card game, why you change the rules so that you can't possibly win. And the people, the elite, were able to short and the system and bankrupt Bunker Hunt. He couldn't sell his position. They wouldn't allow him to sell until he really was in a position of where he was almost bankrupt.
That's right. Well, when they broke the market, the price just crashed very, very quickly. Because they literally changed the rule where you couldn't, no new buyers could come into the market, only sellers. And so if you get a one-sided market, obviously the price is going to crash. But see, that's what we're approaching now, because over the last 3, 4, 5 years, in their desperate attempt to hold the price of silver down, these, what we call the bullion bankers, I don't know how we ever called them that, it would be the big bankers like, maybe Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, we know they're very, you know, involved in the futures market and the gold and silver market. They are now short somewhere at least 400 million ounces, because not only do they have their short position in the COMEX, they have call options that they've written, and Ted Butler, who's a real student of what's going on in that market, has said the short position could be as much as 600 to 800 million ounces. Now that presents a real problem, because the amount of silver that it's in storage on the COMEX is only somewhere around 120 million, but that really doesn't tell the whole story, because of that 120 million, maybe 50 million of it is what's called registered that could be delivered. A lot of people may store their silver there because it's convenient, because they don't want to have to, you know, take delivery of it, but they have no intention of ever of selling it anytime soon. So even though it's on the market, doesn't mean it's available to the market. So you probably have a float or availability of maybe 40 million ounces max, and all of a sudden the shortages are starting to manifest all around the globe. So as people wake up to the reality that there is a shortage coming, in fact, there's been big groups, investment groups, and probably consumers in silver that are having trouble getting silver. So their last hope is to take a contract out on the futures market and then exercise their option to take delivery. Well, if that's coming, then you've got what's called a real serious squeeze play, so that could drive the price of silver up dramatically very, very quickly.
And, Chris, here this last few days, they've driven the price not up but down, and that was an amazing thing. They were selling silver they didn't have, but that's the way the game is played. And if you get into this game and try to play against them, they're going to get you. But you have to know what the law of supply and demand is. There's more demand than there is supply, and pretty soon they're not going to be able to continue playing the game. So we're going to be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown, and of course we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, who's one of the supporters of our ministry, but we put him on from time to time because we want him to keep our listeners abreast of what's really happening in the gold and silver market, what's really happening financially as America moves from the greatest lender nation in the world to the greatest debtor nation in the world. And certainly we see today America is totally dependent upon China and Japan and other countries to buy our debt. And how much longer they're going to continue buying our debt when they buy the debt and then the value of the dollar falls, so that they not only are not getting much in the way of interest, they're actually losing the value of their investment. So these are difficult times for the average individual to survive. And if they don't make preparations now, I'm firmly convinced that a significant part of our population is going to be wiped out within the coming financial collapse that has to come to this country. The International Monetary Fund has warned several times recently that America's massive debt and excessive spending threaten the stability of the entire world monetary system. Have you read those reports, Ron?
Yeah, and I've heard you report them. Yeah, I went, in fact, when you first reported, I went and checked them out, and that's exactly what they were saying. So, yeah, it's the whole world is jockeying for position to repudiate the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
And yet, of course, America is the largest, buyer in the world. We are, other countries are just selling into our market because we're the major consumers. Now, if we get to a point where we can't consume, what happens to the economy, say, of countries like China and South Korea that are dependent upon exporting to us, Japan?
Well, I think that's why they're trying to do it very gradually, because as we shift all of our jobs overseas, then the new creators of wealth will be these nations who now have those jobs, and they're producing the wealth. So eventually they won't need the U.S. as much because we're just buying on credit. So they want to gradually just fade away from their overdependence on the U.S. as they develop their other markets, and they'll basically abandon us at some point.
Well, what's really so interesting is that government officials, U.S. government officials, are encouraging industries to move overseas. They offer to subsidize the industries as far as if their industries are nationalized, their plants are nationalized, well, we'll give them the money back. We give them special tax breaks so they don't have to pay taxes if they're overseas, whereas if they come back here, they produce in the United States or bring the money they've made overseas back here and reinvest in this country while they have to pay a 35% tax on it, it's a no-brainer that people are not going to bring their money back to the United States. So we're actually encouraging our industries to go overseas, and many of those are actually subsidized through the Overseas Investment Corporation or other government agencies by loans from various international agencies. Everything is being done to transfer America's economic wealth to other countries. And you say, well, why would we do that? Well, very simply, there is a master plan. Those of you who have not read the Earth Charter need to get a copy. We'll provide it for you. It's written by Mikhail Gorbachev. You remember him. He was the dictator of Russia. Maurice Strong, a multi-billionaire, and Stephen Rockefeller. And in that, they talk about the redistribution of the wealth, not only within countries, but between countries. And that's what's happening today. But they don't dare tell the American people that they plan to impoverish us, because the American people wouldn't like that. And so they have to keep them fat, dumb, and happy just a little longer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was just discussing the Earth Charter, which is this international document written by the elitists, Mikhail Gorbachev, former dictator of Russia, Maurice Strong, who leads the environmental movement, former member of the Club of Rome, very closely related to the Rockefeller trillions of dollars, their massive wealth, and then, of course, Stephen Rockefeller, who will be the senior of Rockefeller, in my estimation, once David Rockefeller dies, in the Earth Charter, which was presented to the United Nations, and although not adopted, is being implemented throughout the world, and by our own government, remember, they're keeping it in the Ark of Hope, which is, of course, the a satanic counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. And, of course, the Earth Charter is to replace the Ten Commandments of God. But there they talk about the necessity of redistributing the wealth within countries and between countries. And that's why we're shipping our jobs overseas, why we're outsourcing our jobs and our industries, and government is actually subsidizing industries as they move offshore. But as I mentioned when we were at the break, why they don't want the American people to realize what's going on. If you have not yet read the Earth Charter, it is contained within my Sustainable Development syllabus, which you need to get by calling 1-800-544-8927, or if you would like just to get a simple copy of the Earth Charter, and you can't find one on the internet, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you the copy of that document, which is really the mind account for the world, only you're not going to hear about it from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw. Well, we're getting into what's really happening economically in the world, and there is a plan to impoverish our nation and the American people. Would that be a fair statement, Ron, or is that just going too far out on a limb?
Well, I remember when I first got involved in this way back in the mid to late 70s, I used to read the comments of the big New Brzezinski and Cyrus Vance and all these people that were in this newly formed Trilateral Commission that when I found out about it, I was just went out on the speaking tour to speak to any group that would hear me, and I would never speak without talking about the Trilateral Commission. That's exactly what they were saying back then, and that is we must take an end-run around national sovereignty, erode it piece by piece, raise the standard of living of the undeveloped countries of the world, while we lower the standard of living of America so they can more comfortably be merged into a new world order. And I don't know how you could read that and see what's been happening over the last 30 years and not see that that was an obvious an agenda that they've been working at.
Well,
very,
of course,
successfully.
Well, as Barry Goldwater said in his book With No Apologies, the Trilateral Commission is intended to be the vehicle for multinational consolidation of the commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States. The Trilateral Commission is intended to be the vehicle for multinational consolidation of the commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States. And of course, what they're really talking about is banking interests of the entire world. But of course, first of all, you had to control the United States. And you'll find that in his book, With No Apologies. I believe it's on page 280, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, the quotation you can find in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. So we're facing people of great wealth who want to redistribute the wealth of the listeners to this program. They're not going to redistribute their own wealth, but that's really what this whole internationalist elite are up to. They want to control us, and they're doing a good job because they control the monetary system right now. And if you control the monetary system, and you can create a crisis, eventually you will impoverish the people, and they will come with outstretched hands looking for help to the new ruling elite. Well, what can people do to try to protect themselves in times like this, Ron?
Well, you know, obviously what's been happening is the history of all paper money, fiat currencies throughout history is clear. They always collapse, and that's exactly what's starting to happen with the dollar. So in order to protect themselves, people have to wake up to what is happening to the paper money and make investments that will protect them from that. And, of course, historically, that has been tangibles, gold and silver and things that are real value and not the promise of someone else.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with Ron Brown, and we welcome your calls across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. And we only need to understand that what is aimed is to destroy the middle class of America, to have a two-class society, very similar to what Plato advocated in his book, The Republic, a ruling class, a massive military, which will watch and monitor everybody, and then, of course, everybody else enslaved. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we're going to wait a minute or two to get into how we would actually go about making preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead, because we want to get our listeners who are now listening to the commercial elements of our program back with us. But certainly in times like this, people have to be in some sort of tangibles that can maintain their wealth. Now, property is fine, is always a good investment, but right now property is overvalued, and this is one of the problems. You certainly wouldn't want to go out and buy property, because chances are that sooner or later the value of it is going to fall. But whatever happens, if we do go into an inflationary spiral or we do go into a recessionary spiral, if you have tangibles, why, they will preserve their wealth. Whereas paper money sometimes comes to not be worth the paper it's printed on. That's what happened in Argentina recently. And we know that the dollar now has lost, what, 30 to 40% of its relationship to the euro. What is it? Has the dollar gone up just a little bit here recently, Ron?
Just recently. It's gone from, what, 84, 85 on the dollar up to 90. But that's to be expected because, as you mentioned, if the U.S. collapses, if the dollar collapses overnight, then we're no longer the consumers and the whole world goes into a depression. So the whole world, while they want out of dollars, are kind of stuck in the lifeboat with us because they have $6 to $9 trillion of their money tied up in dollars. So if the dollar collapses, they lose all that, plus they lose the trade and the business that is created. So what they have to do is, while they are jockeying to get out of their dollars, when the dollar gets too weak, then they have to come to the rescue and step in and support the dollar, prop it up, let it rise a little bit, and then the Stan Masters on Wall Street and so forth will say how this is the bottom's in and everything's now is fine, so hop in, the weather, you know, is fine. And of course it's not. So what you're going to see is these temporary rallies, which will last 2-3 weeks, maybe a month, and then they will go back into a tailspin, and the dollar is just probably going to keep ratcheting lower and lower and lower for the foreseeable future.
But it'll go up and down, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but the rallies will be short-lived, and it'll just get a partial recovery of what it lost on the last drop, and then it'll turn around and start back down and ratchet to new lows, and then they'll step in and support it again, and it's just going to keep going lower for who knows when, because the dollar is in the process of being repudiated. It's just a matter of time, although we don't know exactly how long or how it will unravel. It's pretty clear what's starting to happen.
All right, hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Ron Brown, and we're talking about what's happening economically. Right now, we're really almost totally dependent, at least largely upon Japan, which is buying America's debt. It said that last year they put out something like $200 billion investing in American debt to keep our country afloat. China is doing the same thing, to a lesser extent, is helping us because they need us to continue buying their goods. Now, apparently, with a lot of the money they're getting, they're buying commodities. In other words, copper and scrap steel and other things that they will need in the future. They don't want to have a lot of dollars in, you know, just sitting around. So they're actually buying real things, the tangible things that they can use in their production, in their multiple factories over there, literally thousands of foreign factories that have relocated to China, many of them American corporations that are producing goods that now we buy here in America. They're American goods. They're made by American corporations, but American corporations that are in China. And as it was Napoleon who said many years ago, let China sleep, for when China awakens, the world will tremble. Well, if you look at the predictions of the elite here in this our country, and they begin to analyze what's going to happen, they think that 10 to 15 years from now, the major industrial countries in the world will not be the United States and Germany, as we've had it in the past, Japan, as we've had it in the past. but China, India, Russia, and Brazil. And we're talking 10 to 15 years, well within our lifetime, and the elite are planning it, and they're doing everything they can to help these countries eclipse America's productive capacity. People say, that could not happen. Our leaders wouldn't do that to us, and I would suggest that they would because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to this internationalist dream. And if you have not read the Earth Charter, which is really the basis of what's going on today, we'll be glad to send you a free copy of that if you just call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for the Earth Charter, or maybe better still, you ought to get a copy of our Sustainable Development Syllabus, which has so much in it that will help you to understand what's going on in the world today. Ron, I understand you have something you've written up. In fact, I've read it, and it's really one of the finest analyses of what's going on I've seen. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about what you wrote recently?
The slogan I've used in my business ever since I got started is investments for uncertain times. So what I was just trying to explain to people is that the monetary system that this nation has been on since 1913 is now in a state of unraveling and collapse, and that the people, in order to protect themselves from it, have to wake up and understand how that system works so they can best protect themselves from it. And then, you know, the main thrust of what I was trying to say is that our monetary system, since it's based on nothing but debt, really becomes like a Ponzi scheme, in that you must keep the system growing at all costs. Because if you ever let the system go into a deflationary downdraft, then you don't have the money to service this massive debt structure that has gotten so unwieldy over the last 50, 60, 70 years, that it really has become unsustainable. So knowing that, you can almost guess what the politician, the monetary authorities, will do. They will always, always elect to try to inflate their way out of it, because to not do so would send us into a 29-style banking panic, which, as people know, was over very, very quickly, and the banking system collapsed, and all the banks were going totally out of business. They cannot allow that to happen with the debt structure we have today, because it would just be a total destruction of our society. So they will always elect to print, and that's what they're doing now. That's what these $500 billion trade deficits is all about, and the budget deficits of $500 to $700 billion. No telling what they really are, because, as you know, Dr. Stan, in the past you could always take their admitted deficit and add the Social Security and the other off-budget things to it, and almost double the deficit. So it wouldn't surprise me if our real true deficit today was running approaching $1 trillion right now.
Well, I think with war, as long as it continues over there in Iraq, and we have to continue pouring in more and more money to keep our troops there, and, of course, all the other things that are involved, as we set out to rebuild this country, it was been around for a long time, that we allowed Saddam Hussein to steal about $10 trillion or somewhere $5 to $10 billion of the oil for food money, and he just got that and sold it away in banks throughout the world, and we don't seem to be going after that. We seem to be very much in favor of taking money that some American soldiers were captured by the Iraqis and tortured by the Iraqis during the first Gulf War, and they won a large lawsuit against the Iraqi government. The funds were frozen here in America, but the Bush administration took that away from the American soldiers that were tortured. They want to send that over to Iraq to rebuild Iraq, and, of course, large sums of money for Halliburton and other favored companies that they're going to make out like pirates, and the tortured American citizens, American soldiers, simply will lose out. Well, financially, however, America really, I believe, is more or less on tottering. We are told that, well, our corporations are really doing a lot better now than they were a year or so ago. They're making more money, and that's really true. They're making more money, but they're not making it here in the United States. They're making it by manufacturing overseas, or by increasing productivity, by coming up with systems of where the individual worker produces more, and that productivity is said to have gone up something like 8%. Here in the United States, that means that we will have 8% less jobs to produce the same amount of material. And so everything that is happening is cutting back on our jobs. You heard last month we had 300,000 new jobs in America. It really sounds great, doesn't it? But, you know, it's said that figures don't lie, but liars figure. According to Bob Chapman, about 290,000 of those 310,000 new jobs were part-time jobs. They just didn't mention that, and they were not good-paying but low-paying jobs. So things are never quite what they appear to be. Have you heard any things that would confirm what I just said at all? Well, sure,
that's exactly what happened. But to get back to, see, as they inflate and as they create the money, and a lot, of course, the way they do it is through the real estate market. We've discussed that previously. What they've done is use Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and these quasi-government agencies to pump literally trillions of dollars into the mortgage market, forcing real estate prices higher. They're keeping mortgage rates artificially low, telling people to come in and refinance their house at, you know, 4% or 5% versus 7 or 8%. And, of course, that does two things. One, it takes a little of the burden off of their mortgage payment, so they have more money to spend, and they have a little more feeling of wealth and prosperity. But, of course, too many of them, unfortunately, have chosen to borrow against the equity so they can keep up with the Joneses. But the point being is, as they inflate, yes, you're creating more money, so the corporations are making more money. So you have created the illusion of wealth. But the, you know, to every coin there's another side. There's two sides, and the other side of that coin is, as they print the money faster and faster and faster, then what they have done is destroy, or start to destroy, the value of the dollar. And as we said earlier, the dollar has dropped 40%. So, you know, that's the payback or the reaction to the action, and that is to inflate. We're destroying the value of the dollar. Now, as that happens, as people see the paper currency losing value, then they naturally would lean towards buying more gold and silver. And then getting back to where we started, where these international bankers or these big bullion bankers who've been shorting and selling silver contracts are now trapped in their short positions. And we mentioned the figure of 400 million ounces. Let's run with that a little bit. There's only 20 to 30 million ounces of silver to be delivered, and yet they're short 400 million, and yet so many people are jumping into the silver market, they have lost their ability to suppress the price at will as they could do 4, 5, 6 years ago. If you recall, when silver was $4 and $5 an ounce, whenever it would try to rise to $5, they would come in and squash it down to $4 just almost overnight, and it would take 6 months to get back to $5. Well, now the balance of power has shifted dramatically to the bullish side, where there's more and more people waking up and want to buy gold and silver. And so now the squeeze is coming, because how do they get rid of their short positions? Because in order to cover your shorts, you have to do what? You have to come in and buy, don't you? So if they come in to buy silver to cover their short positions, they would drive the price through the roof. Now, you mentioned on the beginning of the program that they had busted silver over a dollar this last week.
In other words, they dropped it about a dollar, and it was simply all manipulation. Down within two days, it was down a dollar. Anybody who was in the market, long in the market, just got wiped out.
Yeah, let me give you my opinion of what they've done. I've seen them do this time after time throughout 25 years. Is you have the manipulators on the short side suppressing the price of silver, so they're selling silver contracts. And on the long side, the people that are buying silver, at this time it's primarily these tech funds, these hedge funds, who are coming in to buy silver in the futures market, because they're doing it as a speculation. Now, typically these type of funds are run by the mathematical geniuses who have their computers and their economic models, and they trade these charts. And it's, to me, it's kind of like a second Louis coming out of West Point. You send him over to put him in charge, you know, in Vietnam, one of the battles. He may have all the bookkeeping and all the book learning, I mean, but he doesn't know how the game is fought. So these tech funds are just easy prey to these cut in traders and the international bankers. And so what they do is wait till the tech funds. The silver's been going from 6 to 8.30 since January the 1st, so it's up over 35%. So the tech funds that have been trading silver from the long side have been making big money doing it, and they're probably getting a little exuberant and a little arrogant, which happens when you're making a lot of money, and so they get overextended, and that's when the bankers see their opportunity. So what they will do is simply come into the market and start selling, because keep in mind, they have an empty checkbook. They can sell as much as they want to. Once they start the price down, then one, the program trading starts to kick in to sell out, and then you create what's called a margin call. And when you're trading on high leverage, you have to keep a certain amount of money in your account. And when the price is going down, that money goes down. And so the broker will call the traders and say, if you want to keep those trades on the books, you must come up with more money. And if they default on those margin calls, then you just add fuel to the fire, because they sell out your position, and it just flushes the whole thing down very, very quickly. And that's what we saw happen Tuesday. I think it was down, 59 cents? Then the next day it was down 40-something cents.
Well, of course, the market is run by greed and fear. And when you're greedy, you get in there, you get overextended, you get overconfident, and then they will dump the market, and you get fear, and you can't sleep, and you sell out just before it levels off or goes back up again. That's why the average individual should never be in that sort of a market, because the commodity market is an excellent way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. And so our advice is just don't even think about that, but understand what they're doing and try to take a position and then hold it, but don't get into a leveraged position. Ron, how can people reach you and get a copy of that report that you've written?
That's 1-800-595-0561.
Give that once again,
1-800-595-0561.
All right. What do you think people ought to be doing at this time? If you were somebody out in the listening audience and you saw what was coming down the line and you believed that there really is a potential problem, then what would you do what would you suggest they do to protect themselves with whatever they have? Because I think the first thing for people to do is get out of debt as much as you possibly can. And don't go out buying things just because they're cheap, or just because you think you might like to have one, or because you can buy it with nothing down and no payment for a year. That's a trap. They're doing everything they can to get you by and get you overextended. And do not refinance your house to fix it up or buy a car or something like that, because you may end up with no car and no house down the line. It's times like this when wealth goes from weak hands to strong hands, and most of the listeners to this program are weak hands, and the international financiers, the banksters, and others are the strong hands, the people who manipulate our market. But most of these, of course, are not only interested in the money, they're also interested, many of them, in this idea of the New World Order and the New World Religion. So what should people be doing, Ron?
Well, in my letter, I talk about the traditional investments that people look to and try to analyze each one. The first one, of course, is the stock market, and there's a lot of spin coming out of Wall Street that, we've had this recovery from the October of, 02 lows, I guess, 01, when the market's, rallied over the last 2 years, recovered maybe 50, 60, 70% of its losses. So now the spin is telling you the stock market's going to go up. Well, typically, after you've had a bubble, you'll have the first crash down, and then the powers to be in politics and the government will come and try their best to put Humpty Dumpty together again. And that's what they've been doing the last 2 years with the printing press, creating the illusion of recovery. But typically, if you go back and look at the 29 crash, for example, you had the first crash, then you had a recovery where it recovered 50 to 60% of its losses, got up to about 195 on the Dow, and then it turned around, and the next stop on the second wave down was 40 on the Dow. So I would caution people to be very careful in the stock market. This recovery is mostly based on hot air and hype, and it's going to be very difficult to sustain that. So the first thing I would say is try to get out of the stock market in general. The only exception to that may be some shares in the gold and silver shares, because they could prosper in a crisis. So you might put a little bit of money into that. But don't have your money in the stock market in general. And, of course, that's a real problem for a lot of people that have 401ks. They really have very little choice on that because they're kind of stuck in the system.
Well, at least they could be in gold and silver stocks, though, which have the potential to go up, whereas I fear that so many of the others have the potential to go down.
Except most of them don't have that option in a 401k. You see, the government, I mean, the company gives you several options, and it's a growth fund or a conservative fund or bonds or CDs or T-bills or something like that. So they really don't have much option on what to do with that. You can, some companies will allow you to borrow some of that money. It's your money, so I would encourage people, if they can, do some of that and just put it into real silver.
And so you think silver is the way to go. And when we get back, we've just got a couple of moments more to talk about, you know, if you're going to buy silver and what form you'd buy it in. We'll be back in just a moment here with Ron Brown. Well, we've been talking about what's happening financially here, and we have Ron Brown about once every month on. Ron, what's the best buy? Would it be silver coins? Would it be silver rounds? Would it be 100-ounce silver bars? What's the best way, if anybody's going to take physical possession of silver, to hold it?
I'll give you my priority, and then we'll go and discuss the first two or three. The first place I think I'll invest in silver would be in what we call the pre-1965 coinage. The misnomer, they call them junk bags, but because they're used coins, but they were the silver coins that we used as our money prior to 1965. And those were 90% silver, and they're dimes, quarters, and halves. A bag, by definition, is $1,000 of those coins, so if it was dimes, you would have 10,000 dimes. That's the equivalent of about 720 ounces of silver. The reason I like those is, one, it's silver in small increments if people know what it is, and two, you can't make any more of those pre-65 coins, so when the demand surges, as it's surely to happen over the coming months, then the availability of those bags will dry up. And in 1999, for example, those bags went to a 57% premium in 2 weeks. So that would be my first way of saying people ought to buy silver. My second would be the U.S. Silver Eagles. And that's kind of a new favorite of mine. I used to like the silver rounds over the Eagles, but the United States is now totally out of silver. It has to, the mint has to go out into the free open market to buy whatever silver it needs for that silver production. So I think there's going to be a chronic shortage of those coins in the future, and those coins could go to a heavy premium. Two, just as the 1/10-ounce gold eagles did back in 1999. My third would be the silver rounds, which is just the same thing as the silver eagles, except they're minted by the private mints, and you can buy them a little cheaper than you can the eagles, but the premium is very solid, I think, on the eagles. The fourth would be, I guess, 100-ounce bars, and if you've got, you know, if you've got a little bit of all of those, then you might want to look at some silver, old silver dollars, not in the semi-numismatic range, not get into the high-grade coins, which going for $115, $120 an ounce now.
You're not suggesting then that people get into the collectibles?
No, I don't think it's, most people, one, aren't prepared for it. Two, they don't realize that the minimum markup on those type of coins is 25% to 30%. But if you go into that realm and you don't know what you're doing, you may pay 50 to 75%.
Okay. Well, we're out of time. I'm going to have to let you go, Ron. But thank you so very much for being with us. Do you have any parting thought for our listeners?
Well, just people need to understand that we're into different times where everything that we have taken for granted in our society, is coming, is being tested now. And truth is what will set you free. So then people need to dedicate themselves to really understanding what is going on so they can best protect themselves from.
I want to get your telephone number up one more time.
That's 1-800-595-0561.
Thanks very much, Ron. Appreciate you being with us. We'll talk to you again next month.
Very good, sir.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Ron Brown. And, of course, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And we depend upon our listeners to help us. If you believe there's a problem, if you believe you're going to get information here, you're not going to get elsewhere, we do hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you can do that by calling 1-800-544-8927. And when you join the Radio Liberty family, you get the four best tapes of the month, you get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you're helping us pay for our radio bills. As 5 hours every day, we reach out across America by radio, by shortwave, by internet, and by satellite, bringing people the news behind the news, the story behind the story. We try to cover all sorts of various subjects, from finance to precious metals, to history, to what's going on in Iraq, to understanding of our Constitution, to health issues, but all of them have a common denominator, and that is behind everything that goes on today. Is a spiritual battle, that eternal battle which has been in force since the beginning of time. And there are those who are intent upon creating a new world order and a new world religion. And many of these people have given their allegiance to the dark forces that have dominated society since its inception. Because that's what this is really all about. The world government that is coming is going to be the government of the Antichrist. And the average Christian doesn't understand that. Why would our leaders want that? Because many of our leaders either do not know or do not care or doing what is most profitable for them or frankly gone over to the dark side. The leaders of both the Republican and the Democratic parties are dedicated to world government and to globalism, and it doesn't matter whether the Republicans or the Democrats are in the White House, we always continue pushing in the same direction. The major driving force behind the move towards world government is the United States, and they're using our military power and our financial power to force the rest of the world to go along with this agenda. And if there are leaders in other countries that don't want to go along with that agenda, why, we get rid of them either by the democratic process or sometimes they have a serious accident. Their plane goes down. It's amazing how many world leaders have simply died in plane crashes over this last 20 or 30 years. And, of course, do not believe for 1 minute that the CIA is not involved in assassinations. I'd suggest you get a copy of our latest newsletter. We'd be glad to send you one free of charge. The telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 544-8927. In that newsletter, we simply quote General William Odom, his recent book, published last year, Fixing Intelligence, where he asked the questions, should the CIA be involved in assassinations? Now, he can't come out and tell you because he has the highest security clearance. So he, of course, asked questions. Should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? What he's telling us is we have journalists planted in the media. Should the Army be collecting, or the Defense Department be collecting dossiers on American citizens? What he's telling us is the Defense Department, in violation of the law, is collecting dossiers on you and your friends and your family. We're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen, and there are only a few of us on the front line bringing out the truth. If you believe that there's a problem and you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you once again, this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us tonight one of my favorite guests, and my good friend, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Thank you so very much for being with us, Dr. Cuddy.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we were going to talk this evening about what's going on in Iraq, and, of course, every day we hear about new conflicts and more Americans dying, and now some Americans, servicemen, have been captured. We know that the people on the other side have executed some of their prisoners, although I was so happy to hear that they did release the Japanese, and we'll hope that they'll act certainly more in a more humane fashion than they did, at least as far as the four Americans. They call them contract workers, but they were actually probably CIA agents. They're working sheep-dipped CIA agents, but they burned them alive, and then, of course, they mutilated their bodies and hung them from a bridge. This is a horrible thing to do, and yet this is really the violence that you see in the Islamic fundamentalists, those people who embrace the ideas of Muhammad, although I'm not certain that all of the people over there who are involved in the uprising are Islamic fundamentalists. At least some of them are, and we know that some people from Al-Qaeda have been coming in trying to get the Iraqis to join them, but my basic feeling is that most of the Iraqis don't want anything to do with Al-Qaeda. What are your thoughts about what's going on over there, Dennis?
Well, yes, that's what you said is absolutely right. There is sort of an information gap, though, and what I'm going to say is in no way excusing what they're doing, because what they're doing is horrible and obviously should be abhorred and objected to, and there must be consequences. However, if you look at it, as I try to do, and I'm not saying to agree with, I just look at it from the Iraqi average citizen. I'm not talking about the Sunnis loyal to Saddam, but just the average Iraqis, you could see this sort of frustration building. There's a war which begins, and unreported in the American press, you find out that there's a lot of civilian deaths. I mean, women and children, you know, are shot up in cars simply because they don't have sufficient roadblocks and so forth, and so the word sort of spreads, and then they get these Al Jazeera images of, you know, little children in the restaurant where Saddam was supposed to be when we dropped the bomb, and there's the little teddy bear, and the civilians are killed, but Saddam's not killed, and he gets away, and so these stories sort of spread, and this adds to, back in the Gulf War, there were, like, I think 100,000 casualties among the Iraqi soldiers and 35,000 civilians, and you got to figure each one of them has a brother or sister or husband or wife, you know, whatever. And so while they hate, I think the impression that the Americans haven't gotten is that, yes, they did hate Saddam. He was a cruel tyrant. They wanted him out, but that did not necessarily translate into a great love for Americans. They were glad they were being liberated, but there were images of people who the Americans had done things to, their relatives, that did not go over well. Now, they can, you know, put that sort of aside, but what you find out is that even now, in towns like Ramadi, there isn't adequate water. The electricity really isn't still adequate. It's better, but not, and here it is a year later, and the Iraqis are saying, well, let's see, you've got all these millions of dollars that are supposedly coming in here to Halliburton and Bechtel, but how come we don't have this electricity going and the water going? So there's sort of a seething resentment underlying all of this. And
what you find out is that basically, it's what I've and what we've been talking about for a long time. The planning for this was atrocious. There's a report. It's still labeled secret. However, there's a copy that's been obtained. And it's called Operation Iraqi Freedom Strategic Lessons Learned. And what you find out is that 8 months prior to the first bomb even being dropped, and 6 months before the U.S., President Bush even asked the U.N. Security Council for a war mandate, the plan had been approved. President Bush, on I think it's August 29th of 2002, had approved this plan that was put together largely by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and, in political terms, Pentagon policy writer Undersecretary of Defense Douglas Feith, for this this attack upon Iraq. And in this report that's just come out, and it's, well, it's still marked secret, but it's available to some people now, it indicates that there was really, it says, on the planning, I'm reading, on planning for the post-Saddam period, the interagency process, such as between the Pentagon and the State Department, quote, was not fully integrated prior to hostilities, end quote. That's sort of shorthand for saying they really hadn't planned for the post-Saddam period. And so what I had told our mutual friend, I won't name him, who was going over to be with the Coalition Provisional Authority before he left to go over to Baghdad, I said, look, not only is there had not been any really sufficient planning, I told him, I said, you have not even begun to see the sort of religious resistance that will develop. I told him that the Shiites are temporarily being rather patient because they saw under this, quote, democracy that we were bringing, they would be in the majority and therefore be in command. I said, but eventually there is going to be a problem there in the sense that Rumsfeld and others say we don't want a theocracy established, and unlike the United States, which has what we call separation of church and state, those people firmly believe that you really can't separate your moral religious values from your government. And so they are somewhat determined to have a sort of Islamic law enforced. And at that point, what do we do? Do we say, no, well then, you know, so much for this democratic government goes out the window. And if they do say that, then you've got the problem of whether, is it a Shiite interpretation? Is it a Sunni interpretation? Then, you know, you throw in the Kurds who want independence. And on top of that, I've for a long time felt that it was absolutely ridiculous, and this gives rise to Iraqi conspiracy theories, that if it took 600,000 troops just to get Saddam's forces out of Kuwait, how do we possibly think with only about 150,000 troops were we actually going to police and provide security for the entire nation? And the reason I said that gives rise to the conspiracy theories among the Iraqis. They say, you know, this is just a recipe for civil unrest, what's going on there. And the only thing they can think of is that the Americans want a certain amount of chaos so that whatever provisional authority or whatever, whoever we turn over, and I'll get to that in a minute, on June 30th, the sovereignty too will say, oh, please don't leave. You know, we will negotiate and please leave all your military people here because we just can't provide security ourselves.
You know, I've been thinking of that same thing myself, Dennis, as I see what's going on over there, and the president says he's going to transfer authority to on the 30th of June, and we're going to pull our troops out. And I say, how can we pull our troops out? There will be total chaos, and you're absolutely right. What will the governing council do? They'll say to the Americans, please, we want you to stay. I believe that's all figured out ahead of time. I'm pleased to hear that you've been thinking exactly the same thing I have.
Well, it seems to be the only logical conclusion, and there was an item about a week ago in the New York Times that was talking about, the title was in part, Account of Broad Shiite Revolt Contradicts White House Stand. The White House has been trying to portray this as al-Sadr's, that young Muslim clerics own minority brand of rebellion, which has advocated violence against Americans. But what you find out is that he has had a rather broad support, while a lot of the other Shiites who have not engaged in the violence say, well, yes, we abhor the violence, but we understand his point of view. Now, his point of view goes back to what I was saying about morality. He and a lot of the Muslims in Iraq, when they see American democracy and the sort of separation of church and state, as we call it, they see that translating into the culture as allowing things like pornography, you know, and we have these freedoms, as we call them, to allow immorality. Well, they don't like that. And so they see our bringing of our type of government over there as being translated into that effect, that if they, in effect, install a sort of Western democracy, as we call it, that will allow things like pornography, which they don't want. And it's not just an opinion, it's not just a religious belief, but they believe that there is no separation of church and state, that you really should have a government based on certain fundamental religious principles. And so it's not just a bunch of thugs, as we've tried to brand them, although there are people who are deliberately trying to kill Americans, and we do have to resist that. But he has the sympathy in a broader context of the Muslims in that country who I think, I'm fairly sure, that when push comes to shove, will establish a certain type of Islamic law. And I've said that for quite a while. And the puzzling thing, and what goes back to what you were just saying, that you had thought that this had been planned in advance, is President Bush had a press conference the other night, a couple of nights ago. And in there, he was talking about the extreme importance in Iraq of making this a model, and that it was critical to the freedom of the Middle East and the freedom of the world, in fact, and how we had to stay the course, and it was worth the sacrifice, it was worth all the shedding of blood, and how it was extremely, extremely important. And then somebody gets up, and I got the transcript of the press conference here, and I'll just read this one question. Mr. President, why are you and the Vice President insisting on appearing together and so forth? And, Mr. President, who will you be handing the Iraqi government over to on June the 30th? And President Bush says, we will find that out soon. That's what Mr. Brahimi is doing. He's figuring out the nature of the entity we'll be handing sovereignty over.
No, for our listeners, Mr. Brahimi was the foreign, former foreign minister of Algeria, wasn't he? Or was he
That's
prime
right.
minister?
He's an Algerian who is now a special envoy of the UN, and he's in there deciding. But the point is this: here it is, a critical juncture. The fate of the free world is at stake. The fate of the future, the Middle East, all of our sacrifices. And when you ask President Bush, and at this culminating point on June 30th, who are we going to turn over sovereignty to? And he's basically saying, well, golly, you know, I'm not real sure. I'm waiting for this UN envoy to tell me. Now, to me, even if you're a supporter of President Bush and a supporter of everything that's being done in the war effort, that doesn't make any sense unless part of the whole overall picture is to have this happen exactly as it is unfolding, which would be a lesson. A lesson is being taught to the world that no matter how powerful any nation is, if you try to go it alone or almost alone, you will be doomed to failure. And only if you bring the UN in to tell you what to do, to tell you whose sovereignty really belongs to, will you have any success. I'm not sure that's what's happening, but I just think it's totally ridiculous to go through what the president himself has said is such a critical juncture, such an important point, and he doesn't have a clue with just 2.5 months to go who we're going to turn over sovereignty to. And the reason that's important is supposedly whoever we turn over sovereignty to gets to tell us what we can and can't do, including militarily. I mean, if, you know, the sovereign nation of X, if you come into this sovereign nation of X, supposedly they can tell you, well, you can do this and you can't do that with your military here. And he apparently has no clue as to who's going to be telling us that.
Well, you know, there's a wonderful book that was written in 1996 by Samuel Huntington called The Class of Civilizations, and Mr. Huntington's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a member of the elite that rule the world, professor of history at Harvard University, chairman of the department, acclaimed by people like Brzezinski, Zygmunt Brzezinski, and Henry Kissinger as a great philosopher. And in that book, he basically says that there are different cultures or different civilizations. And if the West goes into the Islamic world and tries to force ideas, our ideas of democracy and our culture on them, there's going to be tremendous resistance. They're not going to accept it. And furthermore, he makes the point that if we were to go in and get in, this is written in 1996, remember, if we were to go in and get into a war in the Islamic world, because of the kin relationship of all the other members, all the other countries, of all the other people of a common faith, why, we would bring the wrath of the entire Islamic world down upon us. And that would appear that that's exactly what we're doing. Why would we do anything that stupid unintentionally? And that is the question that, that plagues me. That and the fact they don't really seem to have any sort of plan. And as you point out, 2.5 months from now, we're going to turn over leadership of the country, sovereignty, and we don't even know who we're going to turn it over to.
Plus, we've now done the impossible. We've actually united the Sunnis and the Shiites in this resistance against us. It used to be when we came in, we had Shiite support because they had been the oppressed majority, Saddam being a Sunni, and most of the people around the Sunni triangle around the Baghdad area were resisting us, but the Shiites were fairly supportive. Well, now this young cleric, al-Sadr, S-A-D-R, being a Shiite, he's not being, while Sistani, al-Sistani, the older, probably more popular cleric there, has not condoned the violence, he has not come out and condemned what has been going on in Fallujah and on behalf of al-Sadr and the closing down of the newspaper there, which was his newspaper, which had been very, very radical and very forceful. But again, it amazes me that this wasn't foreseen. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld was on the I think it was a press conference today, and he either was asked or he volunteered the statement that if a year ago you asked him if what was going to happen today would happen, he would not have foreseen it. Well, why not? But that you have to remember his mindset. Right from the get-go, he said, well, if you think we're going to turn this all over to a bunch of Muslim clerics for a theocracy, you've got another thing coming. Well, right then, I remember you and I were on one of your programs. I said, yeah, but what if that's what they want? You know, I mean, you say you're bringing a democratic government. Suppose a majority of them want a sort of modified theocracy. What do you do then? It seems like it doesn't make any sense at all unless there's some sort of, as I said, overarching plan. And that's why I keep coming back to a lot of President Bush's supporters, and they support the effort here, and they support the troops, and I believe our troops have performed, you know, very well as to what was asked of them, and they're a bunch of courageous young men and women. But I think there's a misunderstanding of what President Bush is willing to do or not willing to do. On the one hand, he was saying, well, we don't have to get UN approval to defend ourselves, and he gets a big round of applause. But it's not a case of just that he's waiting for this UN envoy to tell him who to turn the sovereignty over to. You have to remember that back some months ago, he made a speech, I think it was back in around September, and he was talking about the UN. He was having upcoming talks, and he says this, I do think it would be helpful to get the United Nations in to help write the Constitution in Iraq. I mean, they're good at that, or perhaps when an election starts, they'll oversee the election, end quote. So he's not adverse to having the UN, having a good deal of deference, just like his father did to the United Nations. I don't think a lot of conservatives have recognized that yet.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And what really worries me is that I believe that we are in the early stages of World War III. I think we are in the Middle East. I do not believe that we intend to pull our troops out, because this was the plan, and anybody can read that in the writings of the Project for the New American Century up on their webpage. Of course, who is the Project for the New American Century? Why, back in 1997, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Jeb Bush, Gary Bauer, William Bennett, a group of 25 people, 17 of whom were from the Council on Foreign Relations, created an organization called the Project for the New American Century in 1998. They wrote to President Clinton demanding a war with Saddam Hussein. In the year 2000, they published a book called Rebuilding America's Defenses, where they talked about the necessity of keeping American troops permanently stationed in the Middle East, and specifically in Iraq. And they even said that they would not be able to bring out their alteration in military affairs unless there was a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. Those are their words, and you can read their website, newamericancentury.org, or if you don't have a computer, you can get my syllabus on Iraq, The Untold Story, which gives the documentation for everything we say about all the wars of the last century being contrived, and specifically about this war being contrived. And those of you who have read my newsletter, the latest newsletter, will recall that during the January and February meetings of the cabinet in 2001, this is 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack, Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, in his book The Price of Loyalty, on page 96, tells us that at these cabinet meetings, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz were talking about going to war with Iraq. Now, this is 8 to 9 months before the surprise attack on 9/11, and they're saying, how are we going to get into this war? It's not, you know, why are we going to get into the war, but how and how soon? How will we justify a preemptive attack against Iraq? And they finally, they thought that maybe some of our planes got shot down, or one of our planes got shot down by the Iraqis. And, of course, the inference was, although not stated, we could always arrange for one of our planes to go down, and we could tell the American people that. They didn't say that, but you can sort of read between the lines. And one of them said, well, why don't we just, finance an uprising, and then we can send troops in to support the insurgents against Saddam Hussein. But the decision was already made to go to war long before 9/11. That was the excuse that we gave the American people. But nothing was said at the cabinet meetings about Saddam's threat to America, about weapons of mass destruction. That was what they had to tell the people, so we'd send our sons overseas. Do you have any comment on that? That sort of a statement, Dennis?
Sure. The possibility of a plane being shot down, I had mentioned in my book Cover Up, which you offer, and it harkens back to the old Project Northwoods days of the early '60s, where the Joint Chiefs had come up with various options or excuses for why we or how we could invade Cuba. Creating either a terrorist attack in Washington, D.C., or having a plane shot down and blaming it on the Cubans and so forth. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility. Also, in addition to the Project for the New American Century, another group...
Hold that thought there right now. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and he was commenting on the forces that were at work ahead of time, before 9/11, preparing for the attack on Iraq. Iraq, contrary to everything you've been told by the administration, was planned long before the 9/11 attack. We just needed a justification. We needed to change the psyche of the American people. The American people did not want to go to war on September 10th, 2001. On September 12, 2001, they were ready to do whatever the president told them. And that was, well, we've been attacked by Al-Qaeda, we've got to go into Afghanistan and capture Osama bin Laden. So we went into Afghanistan, and we didn't try to capture Osama bin Laden. And if you doubt that, we'll be glad to send you an article out of the Washington Times where a high official is quoted as saying, our policy is not Osama bin Laden first. Our policy is Osama bin Laden. Last, if we captured Osama bin Laden, how would we justify this war? And that's what it was all about, to justify, first of all, the war in Afghanistan. And then, of course, when we didn't get Osama bin Laden, why then, of course, we somehow had to go to war with Iraq, because that was what it was really about all along. But we couldn't tell the American people that. Why they would not want to go to war if they knew that this had something to do with oil. And if you get my latest newsletter, we simply quote Paul O'Neill at these meetings in January and February of the year 2001, 8 to 9 months ahead of time. He's saying that the Defense Department's already laid out the whole plan of what they're going to do with Iraqi oil. That's what it was about, at least in part. I believe also to bring us into World War III, but perhaps even many of the people involved do not understand the spiritual implications of where we stand. So pick up the story from there, Dennis.
Okay. In fact, what do we have in Afghanistan? There hasn't been that much news, but the warlords are pretty much in control outside of the capital city area where Karzai is holed up. That's about the only place he feels somewhat protected. Plus, the opium production is back up, and so that's no better.
And some of the communists, actually, that we drove out of power are now back in power in certain areas in Afghanistan. And that's what we fought the war for in the 1980s, was to get rid of the communists. And yet, the man who was in charge of the military there in Kabul just happens to be one of the people who worked with the communists in the 1980s. So, it really, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right. Well, they're our new allies, and that's why they're cooperating with us north in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, where which was one of the original goals of the whole thing. We wanted to get that Caspian oil out and run it down through Afghanistan over to India and Pakistan, our friends there who have been so helpful to us. But one of the groups supporting that, And also, in addition to the Project of the New American Century, is Secretary James Baker, his institute there at Rice University, along with the Council on Foreign Relations. In addition to PNAC, they had also issued their own reports way prior to the invasion, prior to September 11th, and then regarding Iraq three or 4 months prior to that as well, talking about the need for a stable supplies of oil and how we might get them. And it was chaired, I believe, by Kenneth Lay, the head of Enron, which tells you something as well. A lot of oil people were involved in that as well. And so when you come to PNAC, it's important that word permanent. They would have this sort of Pearl Harbor and a crisis, and they said Saddam was just the immediate justification for a permanent military presence in the region. Now, if you had a sort of Kuwait situation where Saddam is driven out and then we basically leave, we're still somewhat in Saudi Arabia and other places, but basically we leave, that would not qualify as a permanent military presence. So the only way you can have a permanent presence is the situation we have now, where there's still instability, where the Iraqi Governing Council or whoever it turns out to be on June 30th says, oh, please stay. Stay in a big way. Don't drastically reduce your forces. And so who is in charge of the PNAC? It's Bill Kristol is the chairman. Now, to give you just a flavor of his attitude, because if we can, I'd like to spend some of the rest of the program on the 9/11 commission and what's come out there, is on Fox News Sunday, Bill Kristol is a commentator there with several other people. And when this subject came up, he said that the victims' families of 9/11 have no special moral claim regarding the attacks of 9/11. And he criticized, quote, the kind of moral blackmail these families are now engaged in. And he went on to say that the victims' families have no special interest in the terrorist attacks' results. And that gives you a flavor of the sort of insensitivity of the elite, like Bill Kristol and the others.
And, of course, the thing is that right now, there's some people who are saying, well, but we had to really have this incident. If we hadn't, how would we have gotten into the war over there? And there's some people who are sort of justifying what happened. After all, it was necessary if we were going to get the American people to go to war in the Middle East. Well, as Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, there are a number of remarks. When Donald Rumsfeld testified before the 911 Commission, he commented there wasn't much support for going to war in the Middle East before the 911 attack. There's an article in the book of Rumsfeld's War where the author speaks to a high government official who says, "Well, I wouldn't say this publicly, but you know, we never could have got the American people to go to war with Iraq had it not been for the 911 attack." And I believe, of course, there are many people who look at things that way, that we could justify what happened because this allows us to go to war. It's a terrible thing to think that people could be this crass and indifferent to public suffering. But unfortunately, there are people who will use a crisis and mass deaths for their own political advantage. And that is unconscionable in my estimation. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. In fact, shortly after 9/11 happened, Rumsfeld was quoted by an aide as saying, "We need to look and see if we can't pin this on Saddam Hussein, because that would be the justification for launching this plan." Like I said, that had been planned long ahead of time to invade Iraq. And so, what we find out is they're spin is my subtitle is of the book that you carry, Cover Up Government Spin or Truth, is revolving around what was been called, and it hadn't been released, and they resisted the releasing of that August 6, 2001 classified PDB, Presidential Daily Briefing. Well, as it turns out, we found out in the hearings this past week that the title of it was Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. Now, when Condoleezza Rice gets on there, and before most of us had even seen the thing, she's saying, "Oh, well, yeah, that's the title, but it's really just a bunch of history, you see."
And what she said was, this did not say he was going to attack the United States. The title was, Bin Laden Plans to Attack the United States, and Condoleezza Rice says, "Well, no, that isn't what it says at all, you know. Are you going to believe your lying eyes, or are you going to believe me?" And that's, in essence, she didn't quite put it that way, but she said there's nothing in that report that suggests that there was any plan to attack the United States. It was just all old history, and she was lying. But then what would you anticipate? Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, well, I listened to her, and I didn't think she would be so dumb as to say something which people, once they actually looked at it, would see was incorrect. But when I got the thing, I said, how can she say that? Just picking up just a few phrases. Toward the first of it, it says, they're bringing the fight to America. Then it's talking about Bin Laden planning to exploit his operatives' access to the U.S. to mount
the terrorism. Hold that thought. Well, Dr. Cuddy is discussing Condoleezza Rice's testimony before the commission, which she admitted that the title of the PDD that was given to the president on August 6th said, Bin Laden planning to attack the United States. And she said, there is nothing in this report that says Bin Laden is planning to attack the United States. And then pick up the story from there, Dennis.
Well, as you glance through this report, this PDB, and it's rather short, there are all kinds of indications of current interest. And nowhere in here does it say, well, yeah, 10 years ago they were interested, but they've stopped being interested. It goes on and says, Al-Qaeda members, including some who are U.S. citizens, have resided and traveled to the U.S. for years. Another one says a clandestine source said Bin Laden cell in New York was recruiting Muslim American youth for attacks. And then it goes on and specifically says Bin Laden wanted to hijack a U.S. aircraft. And then toward the end, it talks about the FBI information, and this is talking about current information, indicates patterns of suspicious activity in the country, consistent with preparations for hijacking and other types of attack, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. And the last statement is the FBI is conducting approximately 70 full-field investigations in the U.S. that it considers Bin Laden-related, and they're investigating a call in May from the United Arab to the United Arab Emirates Embassy of the U.S., saying that a group of Bin Laden supporters was in the U.S. planning attacks with explosives, period. That's the final statement of this PDB. So once you look at it, it's incredible that she would say, oh, this is just a bunch of historical stuff. It doesn't mean anything about today.
And that she said, but there's no mention about an attack on Washington, D.C. or New York. Well, no, but they're casing the buildings. This is what it says. But she said, well, it didn't say they were going to attack them. So, I mean, this woman is either incredibly naive or she was trying to deceive the American people.
Yeah, and there's right after she said that, a Larry Johnson, who used to be with the CIA, and he's a Republican and contributed to the Bush campaign in 2000, so he's not like, you know, a Curry-supporting Democrat. He wrote an item called Decoding the PDB, and he said that he, this Larry Johnson, had written 40 of these PDBs himself. And he said, this is nonsense. He said, all PDBs start with sort of a historical background, you know, where the origin of whatever it is you're asked to write about starts. But he says the CIA answered the question in this, that the bin Laden is targeting the U.S. He says it's obviously current. And he says the simple thing, and he says anybody who had looked at this would have immediately asked, what are they planning and what can we do to stop it? And this Larry Johnson goes on and describes how what the president usually would do was call the department heads together and say, report back within 1 week any information you got relevant to an al-Qaeda threat. And he says if they'd done that, then a lot of these things like this Phoenix memo and the Massawi case would have easily surfaced, and he believes that, you know, that that would have been well on our way to getting the job done. But there was an article back on the 13th again in the New York Times that was preceding Attorney General Ashcroft's testimony, and what it said was that the staff report was going to indicate how disinterested John Ashcroft, Attorney General, seemed to be in the concept of terrorism. In fact, Dale Watson, who was counterterrorism chief, said Watson said he, quote, fell off my chair, quote, when he learned that Ashcroft had failed to list combating terrorism as one of the department's priorities in March of 2001. Now, what's interesting is in this New York Times piece, there's a counter to that. A spokesman for John Ashcroft, a Mark Carallo, says, well, that's just not true. Every time there was a meeting, Ashcroft constantly asked, is there anything over and over again, any evidence of a domestic threat, a terrorist attack? And so then he was asked, well, had he seen the PDB? And Carallo says, no, Mr. Ashcroft had not seen the top secret intelligence briefing that was presented on the 6th. And then he says, Mr. Carallo said the memo would not have made a difference since it listed, quote, no specific threats. Now, what's interesting about that is every time you pin one of these people down, whether it's John Ashcroft or Condoleezza Rice, and you actually force them to say, don't you see that it was possible there was going to be an attack in the U.S., they always come down to this, well, we didn't have any specifics that any hijacked planes would be used missiles on this date, you know, something like that. And I'm thinking to myself, what has to happen? Does Osama have to call Condoleezza Rice up and say, Condi, next Tuesday at 8:32 p.m., I will have a white van at the corner of such and such a street with a bomb in it. I mean, it's almost like a Keystone Cops routine where these people, unless some terrorist lets them know specifically what, when, where, and how, they can't do anything. In fact, not only can't they do anything, they don't even intend to have any planning to try and prevent anything.
Well, but they're obviously not telling the truth. I mean, if you, for instance, read some of the articles in the New York Times, well, there was a fellow named Pickering. He's deputy director of the FBI. And he has there's a remark there that he was furious because he would keep trying to brief Ashcroft about the terrorist threat, and Ashcroft had told him he didn't want to hear about it anymore. Then Ashcroft's department said, oh, no, that wasn't true. He just kept, Ashcroft was really interested in this. The FBI saying, but he said he didn't want to hear anything more about terrorism. Now, one of the two of them is lying. And the same thing is true as far as Condoleezza Rice. She says, you know, George Tenet was regularly briefing the President of the United States. And Tenet says, I didn't even talk to him the whole month of August just before the attack. And then apparently his office called back to the commission and said, well, he did meet with the president on two occasions. But they know the attack is coming. All the evidence is there. There's all the chatter. And, of course, Sybil Edmonds, as you know, has come forward. She was a translator for the FBI. And she said, if you could hear all what they were saying, they knew there was an attack coming. You know, and then she's been threatened. threatened with imprisonment forever, making public statements. And as she testified 3 hours in private before this 911 commission, and they won't put her on in public because they don't want the American people to know what the government did know. So everybody is covering, everybody is lying, and if there's nothing to cover up, why are they covering it up?
The FBI has invoked some special state secrets provision to keep her, or try to keep her mouth shut. In addition to Sybil Edmonds, who I guess forced Condoleezza Rice to change that word "we" to the word "I," because Condoleezza Rice had said we had no idea there could be an attack. Another thing that Sybil Edmonds did was she persuaded Behrouz Sarsar, who was a former FBI translator himself, to come forward and speak to the commission as well. And he was saying how back in April of 2001, he had a source, an asset, I guess you call him, who was an Iranian immigrant who had worked for the Shah's intelligence services, the Shah of Iran. And he had been on the FBI payroll for about a decade, and he had still had some good sources inside Afghanistan, even close to Al-Qaeda. And so he was, this informant was warning them, and Sarsar had met with a couple of FBI agents in the Washington, D.C. Field office and was telling them this stuff, that there was going to be this attack, and that it would be in the U.S., and the information was forwarded by these individuals over to Thomas Frields, F-R-I-E-L-D-S, who was unavailable for comment, but some colleagues of Frields said, well, he's a really, you know, good guy, and he would have definitely notified headquarters. And, of course, the person at headquarters was this Dale Watson again, who was a curious figure, because in one of my earlier books I had mentioned how Dale Watson, back in 1998, had briefed Congress how they were really cooperating. The CIA and FBI were really cooperating, and he knew about Project Bojinka, and it gave the definite impression that he was really on top of this stuff. And so what you have is, here's information suggesting there were Al-Qaeda agents already in place in the U.S. They're being trained as pilots, and the information is passed from this Frields up to Dale Watson, and so you have to wonder, you know, what are these people doing with this, this information that they have that could have, you know, possibly prevented the attacks from occurring. And so what you find out is that there was an effort on the part of this same individual, Watson, with information or a request from Andrew Card, who's the chief of staff of President Bush, is probably the one who, after 9/11, granted at least Richard Clark, who testified this about 10 days ago. He said that it was former Assistant FBI Director Dale Watson who okayed the emergency outbound flights for Saudi nationals right after 9/11, including the relatives of Osama bin Laden. And that Clark said the Saudi evacuation request may have originated with White House Chief of Staff Andy Card. So what you have here is this individual who's Dale Watson, who's at this crucial nexus. And not only beforehand is he apparently, you know, not doing that much with the information that he has in April that there are Al-Qaeda agents in the U.S. And who are planning something big to occur. But after 9/11, he's the guy getting the word from Andy Card, who requests that the Saudi nationals, who, as you know, the FBI rounded them up, took them down to Texas briefly, and then over to the Saudi embassy and flew them out of the country very quickly. And Sybil Edmonds, who you just mentioned, suggested that they allowed what she called, quote, several top targets of FBI investigations related to support networks of terrorist activities, quote, to leave the country, quote, without ever being questioned. End quote. And so here you have this political person. Now you might think, well, you know, Dale Watson is a longtime FBI agent, but what you got to remember is that Watson is a really political person. Now he rose through the ranks of the FBI without ever having served as an inspector or a special agent in charge. And so he is in a strategic place here to facilitate through Andrew Card the release of these people who may have had some information. And what do we have? We don't have him acting, apparently not acting upon the information that he was given by this source that we had back in April of 2001. And Sybil Edmonds, who had this individual, Sarsar, is now under, I think it's, let's see what the term is here, she calls it state secrets privilege. They've sort of got a court to crack down on her, putting a gag on her under state secrets privilege where she can't talk about what she does know.
And, of course, she did testify before the commission, but only in private, and they will not put her on before the public because
right.
they don't want the public to know the truth. Everything is being done not to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth from the American people, because to contemplate that there was any even inkling of what needed to be done to prevent the hijacking and the death of all those Americans, and nothing was done to stop it, that would mean that they allowed this to happen so they could take us into World War III.
And the point is also that what you've heard the administration say is that, well, this is a system failure. You know, we have to revise the system. We don't want to point fingers. Even the commission says, well, we're not here pointing fingers. We have to fix the system and so on. Well, a former FBI agent, Jack Clunan, who's been on TV a lot, he's now an ABC News consultant, said, look, this is not a system failure. This is a human failure. There were really individuals who made mistakes, and they're not being held accountable, such as why the CIA did not inform the FBI until 20 months later about Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar being in this country. And so he says, this is a case of irresponsibility on the part of specific individuals. Now, in case, you know, some of your listeners may say, well, this is just Bush bashing, let me throw this in, because John Kerry could even have a hand in this. There was a retired special agent named Brian Sullivan, who's up in the Boston area, and he said he advised Kerry in a letter. He actually wrote a letter to Kerry in May 7th of 2001 that Logan Airport, where a couple of the planes took off from, was ripe for a jihad suicide operation, possibly involving a coordinated attack. So now he's sending the alarm to Kerry. But Kerry then waits about 3 months to even reply to Sullivan's letter. His reply wasn't until July of 2001. And in there, all he did was what Sullivan called the Washington Shuffle. He just sort of forwarded the information. But now Kerry is boasting in his campaign ads that he sounded the alarm on terrorism years before 9/11. When actually this information, this rather critical information from an FBI person to Kerry to watch out for Logan Airport, you know, and really try and do something about it, is amazing. He says, quote, with the concept of jihad, do you think it would be difficult for a determined terrorist to get on a plane and destroy himself and all other passengers? Quote, and he goes on in this letter to Kerry, quote, think what the result would be of a coordinated attack which took down several domestic flights on the same day. With our current screening, this is more than possible. It's almost likely. So now here you have a key element that was given to John Kerry himself, and he's doing practically nothing with it but just forwarding it, the information on to somebody else.
Well, I believe that there are a lot of mistakes that were made, but, you know, it's very interesting. I don't know if you've ever read the National Commission on Terrorism report. Came out about, early in the year 2001, with the co-chairman of Paul Bremer. And they're talking about the fact there's going to be terrorist attacks on America. Well, this is 8 to 9 months before the terrorist attack. And then they start out this whole program, this whole report, talking about Pearl Harbor and how Pearl Harbor was just of bureaucratic ineptitude, and people were talking to one another, and it was because people were talking to one another and everybody was afraid to do things and take any initiative that Pearl Harbor came about. Now, I don't think that's true at all. I think the government knew exactly what was going to happen at Pearl Harbor. And to this very day, a great deal of the information dealing with what happened on December 7th, the year 1941, is still classified. And I ask, why is it classified? Are they afraid the Japanese are going to find out what we knew ahead of time? Or is it that they do not want the American people to know the truth about the fact that the government left 3,000 American sailors to die at Pearl Harbor, sailors and airmen? So You know, and then why are they concealing so much today? This is my concern. If there's nothing to conceal, then why have they put Sybil Edmonds under a threat of imprisonment? Why are they refusing to let key people testify before the 911 commission? Only those selected people that they want to give this impression of bumbling idiots. And everything is pointing to bumbling idiots. And I don't think these people are bumbling idiots at all. I think they're brilliant. I think they have to be brilliant to put this over on the American people.
Well, even if they are bumbling idiots, then wouldn't that be a good reason to have them fired, which, of course, they haven't done? And it's only by, you know, I'm being facetious now, the kindness of these terrorists that they haven't attacked us again within the past 2.5 years, since we're still being led by the bumbling idiots. And so whenever I write or talk about this, I like to emphasize a point, because a lot of people are saying, well, you know, they didn't connect the dots and so forth and so on. And so I said, look, this is really very, very simple. And the way I approach it is, even if you accept what Condoleezza Rice and President Bush, all of them said, that, well, golly, you know, we didn't have the specifics, so what could we do? We knew something big and soon, but we had no actionable, as they call it, actionable intelligence. And say, okay, look, you know, let's look at this from the average citizen's viewpoint. You have this PDB, and it says, according to you, Condoleezza Rice, President Bush, that it looks like there's going to be a terrorist attack. It's probably going to be overseas, but maybe it'll be here. Okay, let's just leave it at that. The average citizen, when you hear that, would say, okay, there might be an attack here. Where might they hit? We can't protect everywhere, but where might they hit? And immediately comes to mind New York and the Twin Towers, because they already tried to blow them up in 1993. And so the average person says, well, you know, how can we prevent the attack? Sort of like this Larry Johnson, who had written 40 PDB, said. And so you're sitting around, and you say, well, if it's by, you know, a truck bomb, we might do this, that, or the other, or sarin gas, whatever. And eventually come to the air. And now this is what's important. What Condoleezza Rice and the rest of them say, their fallback position, that, well, you know, we didn't know specifically they would use hijacked airplanes as missiles. My answer to that is, that is irrelevant. What you do with a preventive contingency plan is you try and get a solution for whatever happens, whatever air attack, whether it's a hijacked plane or a private Learjet packed with explosives, small aircraft, whatever. And the key answer is very, very simple. You have in New York City, you have Fort Totten, and you have Fort Hamilton. It's very easy to have a military helicopter on standby alert there, like an Apache Longbow, which has 30-millimeter chain guns, rockets, and missiles. All you got to do is pick up the phone and say, send the chopper. You don't have to have it right by the building. You don't have to have it circling overhead night and day. Just pick up the phone, send the chopper. That thing, an Apache Longbow, could have easily prevented those planes from hitting the towers. And as you and I have discussed in the past, same thing for the Pentagon, because they were tracking that thing. The plane is 50 miles out, they told Vice President Cheney. The plane is 30 miles out. The plane is 10 miles out. Same thing. Lots of forts around there. Just send the chopper. And those planes would have been history. The attack would have been prevented. It's very simple, even if you accept what the administration is saying. But for some reason, when I tell the press this or the media, I mean, I've called up NBC, ABC, CBS, you know, you name it. And I've said, the attack's going to be prevented very simply if you want to know. They say, uh-huh, and down goes the phone, click. It's like they're really, really not interested. And I've told the same thing. I've emailed to Romer, Benvenista, and Curry on the commission. No response. Silence.
Well, of course, the simplest thing to do if you thought they were going to hijack our planes would give orders that the cockpit door was to be locked at all times. It would not to be opened at any time during the course of the flight.
Right.
Number one. Number two would be to arm the pilots with a pistol. Most of them have been in the military. They certainly know how to use a pistol. Number three would be, as a temporary measure, to put the National Guardsmen on the planes until you could get enough air marshals to be on the planes. What they did was they canceled, when they knew there was going to be an attack, they canceled air marshals on domestic flights. Why would you do something that stupid unintentionally?
Right. Absolutely, and taken away the right of the pilots to be armed.
Right, and they did that. A few of the pilots were armed before that, and in July they put out an order that no longer could any pilot carry a weapon. Why would you do something that when you knew that Osama bin Laden was planning to hijack our planes? Well, we could go on, I'm sure, for hours, Dennis. There's so many answered questions. Dennis Cuddy has written a wonderful book. It's called 911 Prior Knowledge. Another one, A Cover-Up. Now, both of those books are available from Radio Liberty. If you have not read his Secret Records Revealed or Now is the Dawning books, in fact, we carry a number of books that Dennis has written, but dealing with what we're talking about now, it would be 911 Prior Knowledge and Cover-Up. Dennis, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I always learn so much from you.
Thanks for having me.
Good night, and God bless you. Give my best to Peggy.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Cuddy this evening. If you haven't seen my video, 911 Contrived, or gotten my talk on Iraq, The Untold Story, or we have a number of talks on these various subjects. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, which tells you what happened at the secret cabinet meetings held in the White House in January and February of the year 2001, that's 8 to 9 months before the terrorist attack, why you want to get a copy of my March newsletter, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We'll tell you what Paul O'Neill said. He was the Secretary of Treasury. He attended those meetings. You'll be shocked at what was said at those meetings. And then we hope that many of you go to our website, which is radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And that you will listen to our programs. You can listen to them 5 hours a day, starting in the morning on the American Freedom Network, the afternoon on the Genesis Network, the evening on the Radio Liberty Network, and then, of course, there are 3 hours of archive programs every day, and you can go back about 6 weeks and pick up our programs. We give you our permission to copy the programs and distribute them. We give you our permission to copy our newsletters, which are there going back to the mid-1990s, and copy them and get them out. And if you need the documentation for anything we say, we have all the documentation. We want you to reach others. We want you to encourage them to listen to our programs and read our newsletters, and understanding that we're not getting the truth from the controlled media. And there's a great deal of information about what's happening, why we went to Iraq, what happened on September 11th, that is not going to be heard from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw, because there is an effort to control what the American people think, and people are paid fabulous salaries not to reveal but to conceal the truth from the American people. Furthermore, if you get our latest newsletter, you'll see the references in there by General William Odom, former head of the NSA, the most secret intelligence gathering agency in our country. And there he asked the questions. We quote from his book that came out last year, Fixing Intelligence, where he asks, should the CIA be assassinating people? Should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? Should the Army be collecting, or the Defense Department be collecting dossiers on American citizens and all sorts of other fascinating information? You have to understand that they are collecting dossiers on you. They are killing people. They do have people planted in the media. And the fact that you've never heard this before simply reflects the degree of control that exists over what the American people think. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in trouble as a nation because we've turned our back on God. We're involved in a spiritual battle, and most people don't even understand a battle is going on. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Again, our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.